agriculture is complex. Even in economically and politically stable countries such as Germany, there are many different players with different interests and points of view. And in conflict regions, farmers are faced with a multitude of additional challenges. Let's take Colombia for example. The country was the scene of a bloody military conflict for many years. And in this episode, you will learn under which conditions agriculture can work there at all. When the main crop of so many farmers is coca plants, the plants from which cocaine is later produced. And also we will ask which research questions arise there, and perhaps even what we can learn from these regions for other conflict regions in the world. Querfeld ein Podcast. Wir reden über die Landwirtschaft der Zukunft. In 2016, the Colombian government and the FARC guerrilla signed a peace agreement. This ended more than 50 years of armed conflict in the country. But to guarantee peace in the long term, profound social and societal change is needed. And this won't just happen overnight. Today, the level of violence in the country has decreased, but in some parts it is still high, which endangers peace. And this violence is financed primarily by the drug trade. This is one of the reasons why, after the peace agreement, alternatives to drug cultivation were supposed to be created, providing a legal source of income for farmers in rural parts of the country. But still, until today, Colombia remains the world's largest cocaine producer. How agriculture works in conflict regions such as Colombia, what part it plays in peace, and what challenges, but also opportunities, the more difficult conditions in the country offer, those are all questions I am going to ask Professor Stefan Sieber today. His research has already taken him to Tanzania, Argentina, and also Colombia. Hello, Stefan. It's very good to see you. Thank you so much for being on our podcast today. Would you like to introduce yourself briefly?
Yes, Julia. It's really great to see you here in the chat. And it's, my name is Stefan Sieber, and I come from a very small village in the Eifel, close to the Belgian border. And then from this, it's a long distance to come to the ZALF, to the Leibniz Center for Agricultural Landscape Research. But I made it and I live in Berlin. And what do I do? What is my, I would say, maybe major message? I try to deal with the local problems in the world, in a very globalized world. And I strongly focus here on, we call it development-oriented agriculture research. That means, like in developing countries, we try to improve food security and nutrition security situations, but at local level. That means that we have, you can imagine, no, that you have certain regions in South America and in Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa, they suffer due to whatever problem, and we try to really find solutions for local problems. And that is what we do. This is our main message. But with a major topic of food security, nutrition security, and of course, in the wider context of sustainability.
So I have my first question to get a bit more into today's topic. And let's start with a definition. You already told us you're working in and with people in developing countries, but also one of your topics is agriculture in conflict regions. Can you tell us what exactly that means, agriculture in conflict regions?
Oh, yes. Yes, I could do. It sounds a bit weird, no? It's agriculture in conflict regions. But of course, if there's a conflict or not, but agriculture is always there, no? And we operate also in Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa and South America. But Well, I can already say that Colombia is one unique country there. There are conflicts and agriculture, and it comes all together. But if you imagine, I try to simplify a bit the world conflicts they are quite often correlated with hunger, with also food security, what we would like to improve, of course. And the causes for this, they are manifold. No, it's a really complex situation there. You can imagine, I have to step back and to say, if we talk about conflicts regions, we talk about also land use conflicts in this context. That means in a nutshell, it is that maybe the land titles are not well defined, or maybe more land users for one piece of land is there, or maybe there is a land use change and it causes a conflict. And this is what we do. It is that the property rights, access to land, is not secured. In our case, in Germany, it is quite well secured. It is, you know, the Kataster in Germany. In German, that means each land title is well defined in a certain statistic, and this is not in developing countries. And this is where it makes the own entire thing, it is very vague, no? And this is where we have a lot of land use conflicts. Then there is wars, you know, a lot of wars ongoing. You have heard about, of course, everybody has heard about the Ukraine war right now. That would be a conflict where you see, well, it would be the extreme to have such a brutal war. And what is ongoing then with agriculture, you have heard about the stop exports of cereals, of maize, and that is exactly also what happens. And then we have also, you can also have a more silent conflict. That a silent conflict would be that there is a population growth, like in sub-Saharan Africa, tremendous population growth, but each family has always a shrinking piece of land in some regions where they have to grow their food and where they have to secure their family with food. And that means really that this is a problem. It's a silent conflict. And also a conflict with neighbors, a conflict with maybe communities, or also a conflict with people who come and would like to buy land, like land investors, whatever you can imagine here. Yes, and then also, well, if I think a bit, it's also maybe pandemics.
Mm-hmm.
You know Corona, everybody knows it. And
oh, yes.
There are lockdowns, and lockdowns can also cause maybe hindered trade, hindered fertilizers cannot be transported anymore. The productivity is decreased, and that also maybe causes scarcity in terms of food and nutrition. That causes maybe also just a conflict. And economic crisis, you know, do you remember the Arabic Spring Revolution?
Yes, I do.
And that was also like this, that is price shocks. And one reason for this is a high bread prices, that people were starting a revolution, or it started just with a demonstration, of course, but also prices can cause really big movements, and social peace can be also threatened here. And this is also something that may happen, and that can cause a crisis. And this is a conflict, no? And this is exactly why we try also, and there is a link already, you know it, there's a link between food security and conflicts, of course, and this is related to land use types. Yes, and well, what is the result of all these conflicts in these conflict regions and agriculture is, it is always more or less the same, that socially, politically, environmentally, and economically, with overlaps always of these four levels, I would say, there is unstable situations, no? And one have to cope with this if you live in those regions. And we know this, that it is not easy. And if you would put yourself in a perspective of a farm, you know, we change the perspective from our perspective to look in developing countries. Just change maybe the perspective and say, okay, I have maybe 4 children, I have 1 hectare of land or below. What can I plant? And now the fertilizers are not coming anymore. Oh, and now the other inputs is there's a lack of inputs because of lockdown, whatever. Maybe a drought is upcoming because of climate change. And then the social organization within this household is really, it's a high pressure on them to get enough because, and these are exactly the subsistence farmers, the small scale farmers. They produce and eat their food. And if they are lucky, they can sell also their goods on the market and have maybe a little income. But the income is not enough in order to feed the family. And then it's getting that your own life is threatened and also the children's life and the malnutrition. And this is a bit name dropping, but also your children, you want to grow them in a proper way, but maybe of malnutrition that they have really a lack of micronutrients. They cannot develop physically in a normal way. And they are also physically, mentally, they are not at the same height like a normally grown child with a proper diet. No, and this is exactly all these problems we are confronted with. And if you're in this region, it's also sometimes really sad to see, you know, that the people really suffer here.
And what would you say are the biggest problems of agricultural systems in conflict regions? Is it, for example, that the whole situation itself is very unsafe or unsure, and that it's hard to make plans for the future, or that it's hard to make investments?
Yes, it's a good question, Julia. It's really a good question, because if you ask this, then I would give you a typical scientific answer. It depends.
This is my favorite answer of all times.
I know. This is a typical answer the researchers always do. No? No, but I would say it really depends. And I go a step further for you only. It depends on the region.
Thank you.
It depends for us on the region. If we look, for example, In Colombia, it's or also in Argentina, but in Colombia mainly, that's the perfect example for this. There's an armed conflict, and then you have 6 million people living abroad already, and nearly 6 million people are displaced in the inner country. No, they had their refugees. No, that's really an impact. That's really high. Then I would say yes, there's really their fear also life in a lot of cases. But if I would then think in a region, in an arid region, for example, in Tanzania, in Dodoma, in a semi-arid region, I would say, yes, the people, they lack what you said already. They lack financial means. Mm-hmm. They lack also water. You know, the inputs are the essential inputs to let grow their own food. And then they have a completely different background, no? And I would say, yes, it depends, but what I can give you now a list of lacking things for people depending on the region. But what is mainly for developing countries in a nutshell lacking is proper inputs, that is also microcredits, it's money to invest. It is also inputs then in terms of a proper production. It is knowledge what is really lacking with capacity building. You have also a development you see. And then you have, then you can say technology transfer is really important, that one can really also transfer new technology towards these regions. But they have to be adapted, site-specific, we call it.
So you already mentioned Colombia a couple of times, and since this is our main example mm-hmm. for this episode, I'm going to ask a few more questions that mm-hmm. are specifically about Colombia. But first, I wonder what made you decide to work there? And maybe you can help us understand the situation in the country a bit better. If you just described a bit the initial situation in Colombia that existed when you started your research there regarding political, social, and agricultural issues.
Okay. It's a good question at the same time. Maybe just to tell you, there is a unique selling point in Colombia, and there, a lot of things come together, and this is a very specific and special country. Therefore, also for researchers, but also it is also said, no, that the armed conflict you already heard, but Colombia faces here a twin challenge. On the one hand side, one call it like this, it's a high concentration on land ownership. That means few people have a lot of land.
Okay.
These are the Latifundian or the historically is it driven. That is on the one hand side a high concentration, but it is also underexploited, the land. That is also arable land, available land still there, but also the productivity is not the highest. Also, you can increase still food security in Colombia, especially for small-scale farmers, because of course, the small-scale farmers, they don't have the entire knowledge of what is on vogue, what is really right now possible, and the potential is a lot higher than it is actually on the ground, and that is something I would say. And beyond this, there is a big informal sector. You know, this informal agriculture sector that people grow a little bit here and there, and they do something. And then they sell it on the street. And, you know, it is 40%. Imagine, it's 40%. That is really great. It's really a high number, no?
You said that a few people own a lot of land. Do these people then lease their land to the farmers? Or do the small-scale farmers, or farmers in general, only ever work on their own land?
Yes, it depends very much, but like the scientist answer, but there are some large scale farms, and then there are small scale farms are not involved. But we have to switch here. In sub-Saharan Africa, for example, it's quite also a lot the outgrower schemes. It happens also in Colombia, but maybe not that much. That contract farming, or that you outgrow schemes, mean that you involve in your big farm small scale farmers. It happens, and then you have contract farming that they work then for this bigger, I would say, enterprise or the bigger large scale farm in order to provide then the harvest to them, and then it will be exported. It happens, but it is in Colombia not. I would not say a tremendous trend right now. It is more the challenge of this informal, not regulated sector, because this means, and you don't have access to those people, also to capacity building is not possible. You know, everybody is doing this. And if you look in Germany, it's highly regulated, everything, you know.
Yes.
And law enforcement is very difficult in remote areas. You know, if somebody faces a conflict on land, for example, a land user loses land because of another person, then there is also no, they cannot easily go to a court and say, sorry, I had historically the land right here. And then it is very hard to have this as a case in a court, no? And then it is often not possible that a small landowner or a small scale farmer can get their right to have access to the land again. No, that's really, there is no security for the people on the ground in this area. And then we talked about this already. There, you have heard about the FARC and the ELN. These are the rebel groups, no? These are, I would say in a nutshell, this FARC is a revolutionary armed force of Colombia. It's historically exactly driven by small-scale farmers who had revolutions, and there were left-wing people like socialists more in this area, in this trend. And this is something they want to build cooperatives, and they have more this left-wing direction. But on the other hand, there are the big Latifundian, and they are more this, I would say, right-wing or more conservative policy they stand for. No? And but the FARC, as a consequence, sorry, I didn't, you wanted to ask something, but I just yes. wanted to say this displacement of people with an armed conflict, that is tremendous. And you don't have an overview on, the number of rebel groups is a lot higher.
FARC is just one of the biggest.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, I heard this word twice now, so I have to ask. Can you please explain what Latifundian are?
Yeah, this is like the historically a big farm from a patron. It was in historically it was a patron, was the land owner. It was, yeah, in most cases immigrants, they came and then they were it was their property, and they built a big farm, maybe Europeans, and then other people worked from then and as workers, no? And these big farms historically caused also a high two directions, and one is the socialism more, and the other one is more this conservative political party. And it is quite interesting because I don't know whether you have heard about Via Campesina. It's closely related to this, that the small-scale farmers group together and they build agroecological entities or communities, and they want to have food sovereignty in a decentralized way. That means that they can grow their own food and enough food, and they do not depend on cities or supermarkets, whatever. And this is a big movement, and very unique is in Latin America that it is closely related also to political issues. That means that normally those people who are for food sovereignty, agroecological approaches at a small scale level, they are also more in this left-wing political thinking, and the other groups, they are more in this conservative, more right-wing thinking. And this is highly correlated. It is not in our case in Germany or in Europe, not that much, but it's highly political also, these movements. And this is, to understand it, it comes from the history that the small-scale farmers had several revolutions to combat, to fight against the big landowners, no? And that is the reason for this. Yeah.
Wer von euch unseren Podcast regelmäßig hört, der weiß bestimmt auch, dass wir, also das Querfeldein-Netzwerk, nicht nur den Querfeldein-Podcast produzieren, den ihr gerade hört. In Kooperation mit dem RBB arbeiten wir auch noch an einem weiteren Podcast. Die erste Staffel mit 6 Folgen unter dem Namen Fruchtfolgen ist bereits veröffentlicht. Und die zweite Staffel, jetzt allerdings unter dem Namen Feld, Wald und Krise, Landschaften im Wandel, ist gerade gestartet. Darin fragen Andreas Jakob und Fred Pilarski vom RBB unsere Forscherinnen und Forscher nach der Zukunft von Kultur, Natur und Stadtlandschaften in den nächsten Jahrzehnten. Sie wollen von Ihnen zum Beispiel wissen, welche Ideen die Wissenschaftlerinnen und Wissenschaftler entwickeln, um mehr Wasser in der Landschaft zu halten, wie Brandenburger Äcker der Dürre trotzen können, wie sich auf vernässten Mooren Landwirtschaft betreiben lässt, wie sich Solar- und Agrarflächen miteinander vertragen oder was Feldroboter auf den Äckern leisten und wie ein nachhaltiger Waldumbau gelingen kann. Alle neuen sowie die alten Episoden findet ihr überall dort, wo es Podcasts gibt. You already said that a lot of people work in agriculture. Mm-hmm. How many people actually make a living from agriculture in Colombia?
Yes, well, it's roughly, I can say, just to compare it maybe for the people here to compared with Germany, it's like 45% of the total surface is agricultural land, according to the World Bank. And in Germany, it's nearly 50. Just to say, it's more or less, I would say, approximately the same. But Colombia has 38 million hectares. That is really a lot, agricultural land. And compared to Germany, 17 million hectares, there is a big difference. It's more than the double, a lot more than the double that you see. Productivity is lower, but you could increase, and the potential is enormous. It's really enormous. And in Colombia, around 17-18% live from agriculture directly.
That is a lot.
It's a lot, yes. It's really a lot. If you look in Germany, it's about only, I think it's in directly employed, I think it's 1.4%. And in terms of gross value added, that you look at the monetary importance, GDP, it's below 1% in Germany. It's really little in terms of importance, only at an economic level. At other levels like nature and landscape, it's a lot more important. But in Colombia, it is around between 6-7% of the total GDP stems from agriculture. That is really a high share. Also, they are depending also a lot on agriculture, both in terms of employment, but also in terms of the total GDP. And it's quite interesting to see that the potential is really high. No, and you mentioned, I don't know whether I shall answer this question before. You just said why you are there.
Yes, of course. Please answer.
Why you're there. Yes, I can just summarize. Well, first of all, I think what I mentioned with the food sovereignty, it's really unique in this country. And also that personally, I have a background in South America. I lived there for two years, that means. Also, I like very much personally, of course, but and this is important, is Colombia holds 9% of the total biodiversity. And imagine, I forgot now how many countries we have in the world. Do you know this?
I am not 100% sure. Isn't it about 200?
Yeah, around 200, I would say, maybe slightly below.
Editor's note, I cut this in afterwards. There are 195 countries that the United Nations currently list.
But imagine that one country from 200 countries holds 10% of biodiversity.
And it's not even such a huge country.
It is not. Well, it is a lot. It's a lot more than in Germany.
Yeah, of course. When I said huge, I was thinking of countries like Argentina or China that are really, really big.
Yes, you're right. You're right. Or even Russia, they hold 10% of the total agriculture land in the world. No, imagine that. This is a capacity that's really great. But 10% in Colombia, not of agriculture in the world, but biodiversity. This is something of all the species, the flora and fauna, that's something really tremendous. And it is something where people think, everybody thinks, yes, one have to stop deforestation. One have to preserve the land there and the rainforest there. It is very important. And this in this very hard, I would say, situation of this armed conflict and the post-conflict period right now in Colombia. You asked me also what is changing in Colombia. Not for good, I would say. I already said, yes, conflicts are rising again, but also the deforestation rates are being increased in this period of post-conflict. And that is something really sad to see, that the rainforest is cut even at higher rates right now than in previous times.
Besides soy, what other things are mainly grown in Colombia?
Well, to be honest, it's mainly grown. It's mainly in Argentina and Brazil, the soya. No, these are the biggest exporters. and only to a smaller extent in Colombia. It's not that well known. So yeah, then, but what is typically for Colombia is coffee. Mm-hmm. That's really, it's one of the fourth largest producers in the world. Imagine that is really an important country. It's also the market power also in the country. The coffee foundation is really big and they have a lot of money. I visited the foundation. It's really to see, wow, that's really also wealth, and it's a high investment they do there. Then cut flower industry. You have, maybe you know the movie. It's Maria Llena de Gracia. It's a small girl who works in the cut flower industry. These are big plantations, and then they are smuggling also cocaine to the States, to the United States. It's a movie, very, very interesting movie. And then bananas, rice, tobacco, you know, the typical from tropical agriculture, the typical types. Then tobacco, corn, sugarcane, cocoa and beans, oil seeds. There are a lot of different things. Vegetables is also very important, also for export.
Let's dive into this topic of peacekeeping a bit. What role does agriculture play in securing the peace in the country?
Yes, I can at least, I would say I can try to do it. It's interesting because we already talked about the challenges of this informal sector and the land titles, access to land.
Yes, and since we said that so many people in Colombia depend on agriculture, yes. I guess it has to have something to do with keeping the peace, right?
Yes, exactly. And if there is a strong link between natural resources, you know, you can imagine this. If you draw a picture in your mind now and you say, there's a proper region with a lot of trees, with a lot of rain, and healthy soils, and you know, the ideal, wonderful, defragmented landscapes. You know, we work at the landscape level a lot in this, and we want to have the sustainability in the land use systems. And if you draw this picture and you say everything is perfect, then you see, like in a fairy tale, you see a wonderful landscape. No, that's really beautiful, and the people are happy. They have enough food, and then I say one step further, then it is a social peaceful region. And this is exactly also a theory in science, and you will wonder now, there's a strong link between natural resources and social peace. If you draw now the other extreme and you say, and now I close my eyes and I would say, yes, it's a very arid region. The people suffer from, they don't have enough to eat, and maybe there are also nomads coming, and with, you know, the Maasai, for example, and they come and the animals, they eat the last produce, they had the last harvest, and there are also animals coming, wild animals, and they destroy the entire plot, what they have, or they grow maize. And then you have a difficult situation. And then with overlapping land use rights, you have also conflicts. And then you have an unstable situation. And then you have, of course, a non-social peace. I would say this is a conflict. Exactly. And this theory in research, in science, says, yes, there is a close link between the abundancy, like the richness of natural resources and social peace. And this is what we are exactly doing. And this is why we are also in Colombia, that we say we have to stop the deforestation. We have to enrich and to stabilize the availability of natural resources. We have to stabilize also the microclimate, at least. And we have that the people can live from their own land. And we have also to give the farmers, because they are holding the land and they are the carrier of peace, then also, if they feel well, they can also control regions They can also maybe have a function in the governance system really to say, yes, here is deforestation. We have to control it. And they have a ownership to preserve their land in a right way. And that they really also have, they see this is my task to control and to manage this land in the best way, that it is also for the next generation available and for the kids. And this is why it is so important to have this link between natural resources and people. And then also to say, yes, this environmental peace building, we prove. And this is what we prove. And of course, we can say, yes, there is a link, vice versa as well. Social peace is a precondition for a good management of the regions, but vice versa as well, that environmental protection and natural resources is also a precondition for social peace. It would be a vicious cycle if we interrupt this and one or the other is threatened. No? And this is exactly what we do, and this is exactly how we operate. I can give you, if you want, I can give you some examples.
Yes, of course. But first I have a question. If I break down what you just said right now, in theory, in terms of the nature resources like land and all the possibilities that lay in this land, there would be enough for everyone in Colombia. Basically, if we cut the pie, Colombia, there would be a big enough peace for everyone. And that makes it easier to keep the peace in the country, this existence of that theoretical abundance. Have I understood that correctly?
Yes, exactly this. If the people, if there's social cohesion, no, that is, that there's in society not a big difference, that very poor people, very rich people are there, social cohesion, that they earn all together, maybe in average, not the same, but there is not too big differences. And if they have enough from land, and also, and that's also one aspect important, that they also seek opportunities outside of agriculture. Because one thing we did not speak about is it would be the worst thing to hold everybody in this agriculture sector in a subsistence way. You know that they're subsistence farming and all families just live from their land. That's not the solution. The solution would be that we generate markets, that we exchange goods and services. Development only comes with exchange of goods and services, and then also wealth comes with this. And with this wealth also, then if there's an income, a certain income threshold passed, then people also think in, okay, I want to have less children, I want to have a stable life for my children, they should go to the school and so on. And this comes with a development, and you see it also in all countries, like in Germany, very well few. The birth rate is relatively low compared to others. But also in China, you see it with the wealth. There is more and more also in average than less children. And in the forecast, it is also that the growth rates are now shrinking tremendously if you look at the population forecasts. But not all over the world to the same extent. If you look in sub-Saharan Africa, there will be in the next years, in the next 30, 50 years, there will be a really steep trend, and it will be the continent with the highest population, with the highest number. That's really something. If we will change a lot in a global view, we will change a lot in the coming 50, 100 years.
Give us one example, please.
Thank you. I was desperately waiting for it.
I saw that, yes.
No, it's what I can just say. I just give you an example that one cannot say stop deforestation immediately and not having opportunities for the people on the ground. And there are, for example, silvopastoral systems. That is, it's called, it's like, if you cut trees, then it would be better to cut only few trees, but to leave a lot of trees scattered around and to build the grassland then and to hold your cattle, and but this in a sustainable way. And it is more also because the world is threatened, the nature is threatened, but then the question is how we can at least now have a less damaged system if this happens now. And this we are seeking and testing, and we are looking at hindering, fostering factors to establish these kinds of things. You know, that you say, for before it was a forest, but now please do not cut entirely the trees. Please do it in a way, in a very sustainable way, that the forest can also, the trees have a room, I would say, a place, but also the grassland can be established and the cows can be established. You see, one have to think holistically, and if you think even more holistically, you would also say we need capacity building to say sustainable consumption, eat less cattle, eat less meat, and also to say how we can maybe have even a completely different land use system, that people drop out of agriculture and find maybe in the rural industry or in SMEs an additional income, and they can even live better from this than in agriculture. That's a bit the transition is important, and this we call also transformative research, how we can make the current system of agriculture more sustainable, including the society and the mindset in the society, the thinking of people, that they understand it and they do it themselves. No? Yeah.
This is something I was thinking about a lot when preparing this episode. People in Colombia are more or less used to this conflict situation. Maybe for that purpose now, let's exclude the wealthiest members of society. But for example, the small scale farmers, they know they have to grow their crops for either selling them or to have an income to support the family, or just also for eating them themselves, maybe. But I wonder if people in Colombia have the time, or even if they want to think about things like nature conservation, climate change, and other things, when they're already in such a difficult situation, or is securing the food supply and the livelihood of the family farms just difficult enough?
Yes. Yes, it's.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There are so many problems. Can they afford to think about these things when there are maybe more urgent issues from their point of view?
Yeah. It's such a good question, Julia. It's really a good question, because you're completely right. If you look, and we have also similar studies in Africa a lot, if you look in a small-scale farming system, a household, and they have to survive, normally the people, they live very much in the presence, and they don't have a clear pathway what could be a development for them in terms of the future. And this is what is lacking, and this comes normally with capacity building.
So they are living more from day to day. I have food today, I hopefully have food tomorrow.
Yes, or I have to plant this, or I have to go to the city to work a bit to come back and to have some money to buy it on the market. Whatever it is, they have survival strategies in order to just live there where they are. But it's very hard without any education to think, okay, now if I send my children to the university and then they have another job, that's not in their mindset. And this is why it is very important to have this transdisciplinary approach.
I think there's one topic that we can just not talk about if we are talking about Colombia, and that would be illegal coca cultivation. Can you please tell us something about the role that plays in the whole system of the country?
Yes, of course, it is illegal and they're hidden. It is an illicit crop, they call it. It's like a not legal crop, no? And it is really one of the biggest problems in Colombia in terms of agriculture, I would say now. It's a, yes, they pollute and harm and destroy other markets on the one hand side. They also pollute and destroy in terms of chemicals, what they leach, then there's a leaching into the rivers, whatever it is. But remember that it's also, let me remind you, 60 to 100,000 families live from this as an income source. And
which is quite a lot.
It's really a lot. It's really something one has to consider, that it is a sector, it's a market. And tell now a farmer who's just producing coca leaves, please stop. And then he says, but you know, I'm not doing anything wrong. It's just a plant, you know, and it's my income and I have to feed my family and so on. It is not the family's fault. And of course, they are not well educated. But if you look at this value chain, it's one of the value chain that is really tremendous, no? That a coca farmer, he would maybe get, I think it's very little. It's 1,200. I saw it in one source, $1,200 per year. It's not a lot they have as an income. But if you look at the value chain, then you will be really astonished and impressed. If you look then on the paste, you know, the coca paste, and they produce from the leaves and the coca paste. This is just like butter, something like this. And this is already $1,400 per kilo dollar. And if you look at this then into towards cocaine in a further processed form, is $3,000 per kilo. But it's still little. It is still little in Colombia, what stays in Colombia. But if you look that with the narco traffic, you know all these movies from the mafia, etc., in Colombia. But then if you look in Germany, it's 1 gram is 70 euros, and then you look, it would be several thousand euro per kilo, it's like 70,000, I think, per kilo if you make the calculation, the accounting. But in any case, maybe I'm wrong. I'm not a drug consumer.
No, but of course, in any case, the margin is huge and the farmers only get very, very little from that.
Yes, and it's not the farmer's fault, I would say, because of this. But it is traffickers, the narco traffickers' fault.
Yes, I think the problem is that there is demand.
Yes, and they are also partly threatened. It's not easy to say, okay, I stop now. And for the farmers, it is also not easy to say, I switch easily. You have at least to find an option that gives, again, a good income. And there are several studies about this. But, for example, only to plant coffee and to sell coffee is a lot less, you know, in terms of money. And you need at least to have a certified solution that means export to Europe and then have a higher price, like the fair trade option. But you know, these kind of things is very hard to decide, no? And it is it's not easy if it's a really, also these processing of coca is in these laboratories, what is really hidden under the soil, and you cannot find them easily, and in the rainforest, no, and this is it's like hiding and hunting, I would say. The government hunts and the processors, the narco traffickers, or the entire sector is hiding, but Colombia is huge, and of course there are measures to have satellite images and to observe, but it is not easy. Neither it's easy to go into this region, no, because normally it's armed. There's this armed conflict, and there are military and rebel groups there, and you can only do this with a high effort of military, and you see that this is also very harmful in most cases.
So a lot of farmers are dependent on it. They cannot just say, I want to grow something else, and do that so easily.
Yes.
But does the government do anything to help farmers transition to growing a legal crop?
There are programs to help and to switch to other crops. But again, here it is not easy to reach the farmers.
Okay, let's just go back to some more positive things.
Yeah. Thank you.
What would you say are some opportunities that the current situation offers to farmers? Is there something positive that can come out of all of this?
Yes, in terms of opportunities, I think what is really good, you know, there are a lot of bad things from globalization, but also some good are that we are more and more connected. And one thing is, you have heard maybe about this bioeconomy strategy. The bioeconomy is something as opportunity, I would say now, as one example only, is that also in Germany, but also there's a European strategy, a World Wealth strategy. There are number of countries of industrialized and also developing countries, this bioeconomy strategy. And in a nutshell, it is that how can we find nature-based solutions? Now, how we can really live from nature and generate income from this? And the thinking behind is that we want to get rid of the fossil carbon, that means oil, crude oil, and all the industry-related, and we want to substitute it from the bio-based carbon footprint. That means that we say, if we generate from nature material, then we have a better CO2 balance. No? That we say, then we do not emit any more that much CO2 compared to the plastic industry, for example. The example could be the inner piece from the car doors in the car industry. They are normally plastic. And it could be also maybe a material made out of plants, you know. And this is, for example, a testing to find solutions, nature-based solutions that help also to substitute plastic or replace them by plant materials. That would be something what would be really ideal. And then also the people on the ground who sell this plant material could benefit from this value chain and they could generate income. That's a bit the idea. And this is fostered very much now at a policy level from Germany, from the European countries all over to find these solutions. And there are many solutions. I can give you some more examples. For example, the textile industry, that they do not use anymore like a synthetic material. They use it a lot more from plant materials. Then it could be also that medical products or the medicine could stem also even more from herbs, spices, and from special medical plants that will be also enlarged in the future. And it could be also very different thinking in aquaponic systems and also systems with a marine bio-based industry. And all these solutions are then based out of grown plants or extracted chemicals, but from trees, from plants, and further processed chemical liquids that are needed in industry, whatever it is, but they stem from nature. And this is where one sees, yes, there might be also an added value then, an added value for the people on the ground who hold this capacity of the natural resources. Now, that's a bit the idea. I would say, as a solution. And other solutions are, of course, because you can also imagine, as one farmer, if you hear these kind of strategies, they're not easily connected now to these kind of strategies. No, but also what I mentioned is to look at the farming systems and to improve what they have, and also the produce what they have, the harvest what the farmers have, maybe to even get higher prices from these products than in local markets. That one say, oh, it is like cocoa production, or it's coffee production. That one say, how can we connect to maybe the European market to have fair trade options and to have a certified solution? That means certified is, you know, these kind of traceability, that we have fair products and we can, and they can, the farmers can get a higher price. And that's the idea of generating additional income and closing the living income gap. We call it this way, you know, there's a living income gap, that you have enough to live, and to close this gap and to find solutions for this.
And what do you think we can learn from the research that you are doing in Colombia for other conflict regions in the world?
Yes. Well, first, I would say it is not generally easy. It has to undergo always the same process of adaptation, because we have in each region of the world different people, different climatic conditions, different investment conditions. I think the process has to be relatively similar. But now, and the technology has to be adapted. But the process, what we are testing always, this can be generalizable, you know, that we seek for processes that we say, if you go undergo always this process newly, but then for another region, then you can be relatively sure that you come to a solution.
There are three more questions. And the first one is the one that we always ask our listeners on social media. And I would like you to tell us the right answer. The question was, which agricultural product is not grown in Colombia? And the choices were tomatoes, papaya, vanilla, and rice.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, and what I can say is, I already mentioned tomatoes, papaya, and rice. What yes. was produced, and therefore I can exclude, of course, vanilla. And I know that vanilla is very much grown in Madagascar, because we have another project there.
And I know that it tastes amazing.
Exactly.
Then, yes. The last two questions. What do you wish from politics in Colombia, but also from politics in Germany? How can they support agriculture there? And what can we as consumers in Germany do to support legal agriculture in Colombia? Legal is important here.
I think what I would tell the politicians, it is a lot less efforts to stabilize the regions in the world per se, because it comes always back to us in our comfortable situation to have this wealthy situation in Europe. That means stabilizing the situations is a must, and we should do even more because of the migration. No, it's not only inner displacement of, like in Colombia, of people because of armed forces. It is that we have a high pressure on migration, and you see it all over the world. In Ukraine, we help a lot, but in other wars and tensions in the world, we do not help that much because Ukraine is so close to us. But that is one thing, stabilizing the regions, but also stabilizing in terms of agriculture, because
to that people do not have to emigrate in the mid and long term. And what is ICI doing, you know, the climate initiative, protection initiative from the BMU, spending a lot of money to preserve also the rainforest. This is our lung in the world, and let us breathe also. And these initiatives is so important, and to have in a globalized world also a strong network. And then I would say, yes, what we can do as a consumer, no? And we normally do not care about this, but I just say the sustainable consumption is really important. And I would say, well, I'm not a vegetarian, no? But I, from time to time, like once a month or twice a month, I really like to eat meat, and it's normally cattle, but it's okay. But you can also just reduce your consumption, your meat consumption, but also per se, in addition to this, because this is one of the best things you can do with cutting forests because of protein, because of soya production, whatever it is. This is a really a vicious circle, and we destroy our world with this. And secondly, it is buy certified products, buy fair trade products, buy, because the people can generate a higher price in the countries, like a coffee planter can generate a higher price than on a local market if it is exported, and if, for example, no chemicals, or maybe in a sustainable manner it has been produced. That is a lot better. And then you know also that it is socially just, fair. It's a fair product. And this is sustainable consumption, where you harm a lot less than buying just at supermarkets some meat and some other stuff, and without caring about the entire value chain, and without caring about a transparent value chain up to the farmer in the other country. The same is with chocolate, you know, that we have a good cocoa production, and that we pay the cocoa farmer a good price, that they have also a good living income.
I think those are the perfect closing words.
Well, I had now a little bit the feeling that I'm a priest telling people what to do, and sometimes I'm on my own, not always the ideal consumer all the time. No, we all deviate from this ideal situation.
No, but I don't think this is what it is about. I think it's about making improvements and everyone doing what they can.
Yes, yes. But thanks a lot, Julia. No, it was a. I see we hardly talk now for 2 hours. Isn't it possible?
I wow. know, and it felt like only 10 minutes.
Thank you very much for your time as well.
Yes, thank you too.
And it was really a good experience, and it was really also very nice to talk to you. Thank you very much.
I can only return the compliment. You can find more information about the topic in the show notes. All podcast episodes can always be found on our blog, www.quer-feld-ein.blog, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, and wissenschaftspodcasts.de. You'll also find other exciting articles about the agriculture of the future on our blog, so feel free to check it out. And of course, we also appreciate if you follow us on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, and like, share, or comment on our posts. And if you like the podcast, please also give us a rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to this podcast. And of course, you can also send us questions, feedback, or suggestions via email to querfeldein@zalf.de.
Wie viele Kaffees waren es heute schon? Kaffee spielt im Leben vieler eine sehr große Rolle. Und das nicht nur zu Hause oder im Café, sondern auch am Arbeitsplatz. Dafür gibt es Lavazza Professional. Kaffee am Arbeitsplatz, der genauso lecker schmeckt wie in eurem Lieblingscafé. Die perfekte Kaffeelösung für jede Art von Unternehmen. Klein, mittel, groß. Ihr habt auf jeden Fall einen Kaffee, der schmeckt. Die richtige Motivation für eure Arbeitstage. Alle Infos zu Lavazza Professional findet ihr auf lavazzapro.de mit allen Kaffeelösungen für euer Büro.
Ich habe mich natürlich schockverliebt, weil die war wirklich ganz, ganz klein.
So begann die Mensch-Hund-Beziehung zwischen Christina und Tierschutzhund Frieda. Und wie es danach, nach dem ersten Moment der Verliebtheit, so weiterging und welche Klippen es danach zu umschiffen galt, das hört ihr in der neuen Ausgabe von Iswas Dog, dem Podcast für harmonische Mensch-Hund-Beziehungen.
Iswas Dog mit Malte Asmus.
Überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.